This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 14, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The war on the streets of Iraq is escalating. We get an update from the scene of a bomb blast in Baghdad.
I can hear now there was a big bomb everywhere around me because I'm in the middle of Baghdad, like across the river from the green zone.
Nominee to head the CIA, Porter Goss, today says the CIA should be allowed to conduct domestic spying. And in Colombia, indigenous people begin an intercity march demanding territorial autonomy. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Turkish government officials threaten to take troops out of Iraq if the U.S. military continues to strike at the Turkmen minority in the northern part of the country. Turkmen officials say the U.S. military is being duped into attacking them by Kurds in northern Iraq. U.S. military officials counter, one town, Al-Afar, has been reportedly taken over by militants who regularly attack U.S. and Iraqi troops. For their part, the Kurds who were massacred under Saddam Hussein's regime have been able to gain more land and control under the U.S. occupation. Turkey's Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül said he told U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell that Turkey would end its partnership with the U.S. if they continued the attacks on Tal Afar, according to a Turkish news agency. Recovery workers who cleaned up the World Trade Center site after September 11th filed a class action lawsuit claiming they were sent into an unsafe working environment without proper precautions. Leanne Caldwell has more from WBAI in New York.
More than 800 rescue and recovery workers filed a class action lawsuit in U.S. District Court. They are firefighters, police officers, electricians, volunteers, construction workers, and day laborers who spent days and months cleaning after the destruction of the World Trade Center. Reports and tests reveal that the site was contaminated with PCBs, mercury, lead, and asbestos, as well as other toxins. The workers say they have developed asthma, respiratory problems, and cancer, and are asking for compensation and complete testing and treatment for their illness. David Wolby is the attorney for the plaintiffs.
After we stopped rescuing people and there was no one left to rescue, the only important thing that needed to be done was to securitize the site, set up a decontamination procedure, get everyone hazmat suits and respirators who was going to work there, and none of that was ever done.
In a written statement, Howard Rubenstein, spokesperson for Silverstein Properties, said they had no control over the cleanup. It was conducted under the Federal Emergency Management Agency. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The U.S. government's pension backup plan will be bankrupt by the year 2020, according to a report by the Center of Federal Finance Institutions. The report says corporate bankruptcies took the fund's balance sheet from a $19 million surplus to an $11.2 billion deficit. Sarah Turner with the Workers' Independent News Service reports.
The PBGC was created in 1974 to ensure protected or defined benefit plans, which are a dying breed because workers receive a guaranteed amount of money regardless of their company's investment performance. Most workers are now offered 401k plans, which are not insured and based on the whims of the stock market. U.S. Airways announced on Sunday it was returning to bankruptcy for the second time after having already terminated the pilot's pension plan. And now it's revealed intentions to terminate the pensions for all of its other labor union employees. In principle, corporations are required to contribute enough money to the PBGC to cover all future pension payments. But employers are getting around their obligations by abusing flexibility on the timing of their contributions. Douglas Elliott is president and author of the Coffey Report.
And it was kind of masked in the 90s when everybody was seeming to do much better than they really were. And stock prices were high, which helped pension funds that invested in stocks. And it also made it less likely that companies would go bankrupt.
Elliott says that to date, American corporations have promised their employees more than $1.5 trillion worth of pension payments. And if they can't pay out, the burden falls on the PBGC and ultimately the U.S. taxpayer. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
Immigrant students and supporters across the nation are fasting to raise awareness about the DREAM Act. Aura Bogado explains from KPFK in Los Angeles.
The bipartisan legislation would enable immigrant students who have attended U.S. schools to go to college and put them on the path to U.S. citizenship. Although DREAM Act legislation passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Bush administration's lack of support for the bill has made it lag on the Senate floor for a vote, despite numerous rallies and 100,000 petitions. The two-week DREAM Fast, a nationwide effort organized by the National Council of La Raza, seeks to bring attention to the legislation, with Fast planned in Oregon, California, New York, and Maryland. On September 24, the Fast, in which participants drink only liquids and the minimum amount of food to meet their nutritional needs, will come to an end, with supporters joining those who have fasted for 2 weeks in a show of solidarity. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aura Bogado.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Al Jazeera is reporting today that a British lawyer says he has uncovered evidence that U.S. troops mistreated detainees in the Iraqi city of Mosul, signaling that the abuse is occurring far beyond the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. Lawyer Phil Shiner sent Reuters statements by two Iraqis who said they were hooded, stripped naked, beaten, and doused with cold water during lengthy torture sessions. One said he had seen a 14-year-old boy bleeding from his anus. The other said he was threatened with sexual assault. The allegations appear to be the first reports of abuse in Mosul. Meanwhile, an explosion ripped through a crowded marketplace in a police building in Haifa Street in Baghdad. We're joined by Salam Talib, a computer programmer in Baghdad, who was at the scene.
There was a bomb bombing come from some missiles actually coming from Haifa Street inside the green zone where all the Americans are using as a base. One of these bombs is coming by airplane from one of the cars. This car was a civilian car. When people get around to see what's happened over there, if they can survive one life or more. So one of them was a journalist, Al Arabiya corresponding in Baghdad. The airplane attacked the same place again after around half an hour, and 40 people killed, and including the Al Arabiya corresponding in Baghdad.
Salam, we've seen over the past few days an escalation of U.S. attacks that have led to many deaths and injuries of Iraqi women and children and civilians. Have you seen much of this?
Yes, a lot of civilians in Sadr City, actually, and many places in Baghdad. There is bombing, massive bombing everywhere, especially in Sadr City, in Haifa Street, and in a place called Al-Rahmaniya. They attacked these places, and I was witness yesterday on Americans. They bombed Sadr City by cluster bomb. This cluster bomb was injuring many children and many non-fighters. I think that they're going to do that every day because they announced for the people in this area to leave the area.
Now, they are saying, the American military is saying, that the alternative, if they don't react when they themselves are attacked, is that the insurgency will grow and that indeed things will get worse, the security situation will get worse. People who you're talking to, Iraqis, do they seem to agree with that?
Actually, almost the Iraqis, they don't agree with that, especially in the places where the fighting are, like Sadr City, because this fighting, it's just from one side now. It's just from American side, and the people in Sadr City, they said it's the fighters just replying the fire. They are not starting the fire. Especially when Sadr office announced to cease fire in 2 days, but the Americans, they said, we are fighting just with the terrorists. So that is not look like for me. It's just they want to control the place. But every day they are losing the control more and more.
And what about in northern Iraq? Turkey's threatened to end cooperation with the U.S. What's happening there?
In northern Iraq, they are Turkey trying to be inside the situation, and because the Kurdish now are trying to get their own government and their own cities. They're making some, and they surround all the Kurdistan now by wires, and these wires is electricity wire, so that is some kind of isolating. They are isolated north of Iraq. Then they said the reason is just because of the security situation because they tried to attack the prime minister in Kurdistan, his assistant actually. This was the reason they said they're going to put all these wires around in Kurdistan to protect you from terrorists coming from north.
Salam Talib is a computer programmer. He was joining us from Baghdad. Today, President Bush's nominee for the new chief of the CIA, Porter Goss, said at his Senate confirmation hearing that it's time for the country to have a serious debate on whether CIA should be allowed to conduct domestic spying. Mitch Jeserich reports from Capitol Hill.
On Monday, Porter Goss, Republican House Representative from Florida, testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee on his nomination to head the CIA, a position the chair of the committee, Senator Pat Roberts, admittingly said might not exist in the next few months due to intelligence reform. Goss told the committee that he no longer supports a provision in one of his own bills, introduced just 3 months ago, to give the CIA the power to make arrests within the United States. Goss responds to questions by Roberts concerning a key 9/11 Commission recommendation that would blur the line between foreign and domestic intelligence.
That deserves, in my view, a full, rigorous debate and full attention in the Congress of the United States. It is a very huge departure from what we've done in the past. And the question is before us, how do we do domestic intelligence? How do we safeguard liberties? But how do we protect people? And I think Congress must be in that debate.
Do you support CIA performance of domestic law enforcement powers?
I do not believe that foreign intelligence apparatus should be used domestically. I do believe law enforcement must be properly prepared with the adequate safeguards to protect us in this country and to protect our civil liberties.
Porter Goss was a co-sponsor of the Patriot Act that was passed just days after the 9/11 attacks, and he is a principal sponsor of the so-called Patriot Act II, which elements of are still floating through Congress. While Goss has been a proponent of increased domestic surveillance, his critics contend that he, as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, has avoided investigating any wrongdoings by the government. As the CIA has been implicated in the keeping of so-called ghost detainees, Goss alluded to the Senate's investigation into detainee abuse in Iraq as unbalanced and circus-like. Goss also refused to have his committee investigate the outing of CIA analyst Valerie Plame, which is a felony. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California asks Goss about a comment he made concerning the case.
If somebody sends me a blue dress and some DNA, I'll have an investigation. Do you believe that's an appropriate comment as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee?
I don't think it was my best comment ever, for sure. I think it was made to a provocative remark to me about the difference between evidence and an allegation.
As chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Goss fully supported the invasion of Iraq based on bogus intelligence that it had weapons of mass destruction. With one intelligence failure after another, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon asked why Goss didn't use his position as chair to try to make reforms.
As eight-year chairman of the committee, you essentially had a front row seat to terrorist attack after terrorist attack. But it wasn't until a few months ago that you introduced any legislation at all to reform the intelligence community.
Senator, as I've said, the record is the record. It was hard to get attention, and if I failed, it was perhaps in getting attention.
I would only say to you, Mr. Goss, you were chairman of the committee. You were in a position to get attention to this issue, and yet you didn't do it.
Coming into the hearing, Goss's nomination had bipartisan support, but his repeated responses of that the record is the record to Democrats' questions probably didn't win him any new support. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin.
That is a dismissive comment that you never should have included, I think, in your comments before this committee. It basically tells us that you're not prepared to answer or discuss some important things about you.
Goss's nomination as CIA director is likely to be confirmed by the Senate next week. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
A coalition of conservationists and outdoor enthusiasts gathered in Houston, Texas today to announce that 1.4 million Americans oppose efforts by the Bush administration to repeal the federal so-called roadless rule that protects millions of acres of American wilderness. From KPFT in Houston, Erica McDonald files this report.
Today marked the original deadline for public comment on the Bush administration proposal to repeal the federal roadless rule. National and Texas-based environmental groups, including U.S. Public Interest Research Group and the Houston Sierra Club, say widespread popularity for the rule led to the extension of public comment. Texas PIRG organizer Stephanie Gross calls the Bush plan a timber industry boondoggle.
Basically, the Forest Service is building and maintaining the roads that the timber industry uses to get into our national forests and be able to take the trees that the American public owns out of them for their own profit.
Under the Bush plan, the 58 million acres of untouched forests currently protected by the rule would be subject to logging. Governors of the 39 states impacted by the rule would have to petition the federal government to protect the areas, a resource-intensive process that critics say is subject to denial. Houston Sierra Club's Brant Manchin said prior to Bush's July 12th announcement of the rollback, the administration had failed to uphold the rule in court.
The Bush administration for almost 4 years now has consistently undercut the rule by going into court and not arguing for the rule, even after John Ashcroft swore in Senate testimony that he would uphold and protect the rule. In addition, in the lawsuits, the Justice Department attorneys have basically said for the people filing against the roadless area rule, you're right, we're not going to do anything.
The biggest blow came to the roadless rule last Christmas Eve, when Bush quietly announced an exemption for the Tongass National Forest in Alaska, considered by many conservationists to be the crowning jewel of the national park system. Manchin said that repealing the rule completely would jeopardize habitat for 1,900 endangered species and drinking water for 60 million Americans.
Most of the roads that we're talking about are gravel or dirt-type roads. When it rains, a lot of the soil on the gravel and on the dirt roads washes off and washes into the creeks. It smothers fish spawning areas. And in addition, if there's any sort of a oil spill or a coolant spill from your car or something like that that falls on these roads, that washes off too. And so that toxic material will get into the water.
Widespread support for the rule means activists like Gross and Manchin have found unlikely allies. 35-year veteran of organized bass fishing, Ed Parton, says he supports commerce, but not at the expense of public health.
And I'm not anti-big business. I'm really not. I think that big business has contributed to make this country as great and wonderful as it is. But the greed and love of money, they've lost sight of protecting the health and welfare of people, of game and fish, and I think that's sad. And I think when we turn this around and get it back to where everybody cares and everyone tries to protect the environment, we're all going to be much better off.
Despite their enthusiasm, conservationists remain skeptical that the administration will be swayed by public opinion. A final decision on the rule was pushed back to November 15th, after the presidential election. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
With less than 2 months before the election, the U.S. presidential campaigns are in full swing. George Bush and John Kerry are making lofty claims, attacking each other's personal and professional histories, and appealing to what they think the American people demand. Low-income families and workers say they've been left out of the political melee. Sarah Olson and the Welfare Radio Collective report.
The stakes are high for low-income families this fall. The welfare reform bill, now 2 years late, is scheduled to be reauthorized by September the 30th. Overtime pay, health care, education funding, and child care are all part of this election year debate. However, low-income families say that the issues important to them are not actually part of the political equation.
The reality is that people don't want to hear about poverty. The people who vote aren't in poverty, and for that reason, they're not addressing it.
Anita Reese is the program director at Low Income Families Empowerment Through Education, or Lifetime. She says that the issues related to poverty have been absent from the political discussion during this election year. Vivian Haynes is a low-income mother and student. She agrees and says that the issues addressed by the presidential candidates don't address the needs of those in poverty.
They don't care about us. They don't care about low-income people. The low-income people don't count. All they want is the vote of the middle and upper class populace.
Malika Floyd is a low-income student. She says that the candidates need to be focusing on the issues related to the survival of people in the United States.
I think they should discuss education, health, jobs, all these things that are important to people's circumstances of living. Either you bring down the cost of living or you provide more opportunities for people to survive.
Vivian Haynes says that it is important to address the issues at the heart of poverty.
I would like to see the candidates include low-income families into their candidacy on a more holistic scale and really think about what they're doing with the root issues like housing, transportation, child care.
Many low-income people say that the lack of attention that the politicians place on the issues related to them lead to a sense of ambivalence when it comes to their participation. Vivian Haynes said that she's going to vote, but she feels that the politicians would rather that she did not.
Low-income people like myself, we don't feel like we're being included in this voting process. We're not of any grave concern for this election. We are being absolutely ignored in every way, shape, and form.
Malika Floyd would like to see the candidates distinguish themselves on the issues.
Well, I feel like I'm between a rock and a hard place with deciding who to vote for. We've seen the damage that Bush could do, and Kerry is not standing for anything. And it's like, okay, I'm going to vote for Kerry just to get Bush out the house, but who's to say that Kerry's not going to fall into the same trap if he's not standing for anything?
Lifetime's Anita Reese says that community education and outreach will be an important factor in bringing many low-income voters to the polls.
There's a lot of work out there to get people to register to vote and focusing on low-income communities, but there's no follow-up. There's no, like, okay, now let's get you to actually vote.
For Free Speech Radio News, from the Welfare Radio Collaborative in Oakland, California, this has been Renita Pitts with Sarah Olson.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. In Colombia, an expected 40,000 indigenous Pais people and their allies today embarked on an intercity march demanding territorial autonomy while rejecting a proposed free trade treaty with the United States. This comes as last week the Pais' own indigenous guard succeeded in rescuing five of their leaders 2 weeks after they were kidnapped by FARC guerrilla. Dan Malakoff has the story.
On a dusty street of one-story dwellings in Santander de Quilichao, southwestern Colombia, a crowd gathers outside the Association of Indigenous Councils of North Cauca. They await the return of five indigenous leaders, kidnapped by the FARC guerrilla and freed by 400 of the Pez people's own indigenous guard. No ransom was paid, no blood was shed.
The FARC has the order to capture state employees. We had to clarify to them because they don't know. We teach them that we are different. We are not warlike, and we are not of the state. We are indigenous authorities who want our own state. They understand, but with pressure from the community.
That's Alfredo Acosta, the coordinator of the 7,000-strong indigenous guard, whose ancestral mission is to defend the rights of the Pez, Colombia's largest indigenous group. Unarmed, guardsmen rely only on their numbers. Last July, they rescued a kidnapped humanitarian aid worker. They dismantle cocaine labs and protect communities from displacement. Again, Alfredo.
Here, there are not just drugs and guerrillas. There are alternatives. These are examples of defense without needing to fire a shot. Through dialogue with the word, we can succeed in rescuing the kidnapped. This is the message.
The escalation of U.S. military aid in the 1990s complicated the Guard's task by intensifying Colombia's civil war. Over the years, guerrillas, rightist paramilitaries, large landowners, and government forces have killed hundreds of Pez. Even now, the government threatens to crack down on the Guard and strip the indigenous of their territorial autonomy, according to Giovanni Yule, director of the Association of Indigenous Councils. El modelo que se
impone en esta sociedad. The model being imposed on us is global, so we need to have backing from the entire world to survive as indigenous people. Alliances with the world's alternative social sectors are crucial because right now we run the risk of being wiped out.
Yet the PEZ have made inroads, reclaiming huge tracts of land, establishing self-rule on 16 reservations, and founding a university to offer their youth opportunities outside of the war. A caravan of pickups and open-sided buses turns the corner, packed with guardsmen accompanying the recently liberated PEZ leaders. Mayor of Toribio, Arquímedes Pitonas, recognized by UNESCO as a master of wisdom, speaks of his two-week captivity.
The people demanded respect for the communities. Obviously, this release was only possible with a community united, organized, and strong. And that is difficult given the circumstances here in our territories.
This is Dan Malakoff reporting from Cali, Colombia.
War, Inc.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
For many people, the insidious interaction between oil interests and U.S. foreign policy has spawned the popular slogan first voiced during the Gulf War, "No blood for oil." Now, over a decade later, such a slogan sounds hollow, especially as the Iraqi resistance drags on and the nation, far from its promised fortunes of a democracy, seems poised on the precipice of civil war. What many of us didn't see was the obscene growth of the private military industries that have been the very lifeblood of this war, and which has enriched these many businesses to the tune of over $100 billion. When we think of military contractors, we think of food services, laundries, clerks, and perhaps construction companies. It is that, but not that alone. Private military companies are, in fact, private armies, sworn not to uphold democracy, but to serve their companies and the company's most important objective, the bottom line. They do what armies do. They fight. Remember the hanging and mutilation of four contractors in Fallujah in April? Those guys were former U.S. Special Forces commandos who worked for Blackwater Security Consulting, the very same group that days later was engaged in a full-scale battle in Najaf, where Blackwater helicopters waged a firefight there while resupplying. As Peter W. Singer, a Brookings Institute fellow, noted recently, sometimes these assignments are described euphemistically as private security to make them sound less military. But these are not private guards who stroll at the local shopping mall. They involved personnel with military skills and weapons who carry out military functions within a war zone against military-level threats. The New York Times has called them shadow soldiers. This is not a war for oil. It is a war for Blackwater, a war for Titan, a war for DynCorp, a war for Halliburton, a war for Kellogg, Brown and Root, a war for Vinnell, a war for Northrop Grumman. It is a war for the privatization of war. It is a war for the basest and the oldest of reasons, profit. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio News, this has been Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective with a collective editorial process. For more information, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. You'll also find a full archive of all our newscasts and documentaries online. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandes.